You might recall the celebrations back in 2011 when the new nation of South Sudan was born. Here was this oil-rich country, such hope of prosperity after decades of conflict with the North. Well, barely 2 years into the life of South Sudan, the country fractured and a civil war began in 2013. And 2 million people have fled violence. More than half of them are now in neighbouring Uganda, which is home to the world's biggest refugee settlement, many also in UN refugee camps dotted around South Sudan. There are very few signs of peace or even the beginnings of a dialogue now, though, between the warring government and opposition factions, and addressing the humanitarian crisis and the sort of changing context of what's left of the peace agreement is perilous. Well, Kevin Chang, though, is well placed to tell us more. Kevin's just returned to Australia from South Sudan, where he worked as a senior political advisor to the United Nations mission. Welcome to Saturday Extra, Kevin.
Pleasure, Andrew. Nice to be here.
It's remarkable how quickly the civil conflict really started. They went through this long war with the North, what we now call Sudan, and then it fell apart so quickly. What is at the heart of the war now in South Sudan?
Yeah, so, basically South Sudan or Southern Sudan has been in conflict on and off really for the past 5 decades. Most of the times as Southern Sudan fighting in civil conflict with its neighboring North, the government in Khartoum. They were, of course, a strong sort of ethnic and also religious dimension to that, the majority of the North being Muslim, Arabic, and those in the South being sort of African Christians. There are many other aspects. There was a comprehensive peace agreement between North and South in 2005. This led to the referendum of 2011, in which 98% of the southern Sudanese population voted for independence and secession from Sudan. And this formed the world's newest state. But of course, since independence, there's been a constant power struggle among those who fought for independence, which is the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, or SPLM. And, we got to recognize that this is a sort of region which has been at war for decades and decades. And really, there's no infrastructure or any kind of functional government by the people as we know it in societies like in Australia.
Was there a trigger, Kevin, to the fracturing of the new country, the new South Sudan, just 2 years into its existence? Was there an event that triggered that?
It's hard to sort of pinpoint events. Basically what happened was that, fighting started in the streets of Juba in December 2013 and around the country. But basically, this was due to the disunity in the SPLM that, of course, won the civil war. But during the independence era, there was a lot of competition for power, resources. Of course, South Sudan is a very resource-rich country, especially when it comes to oil. And there's an ongoing dispute with Sudan about that. And basically, just a lack of infrastructure of the state, judiciary, executive, parliament, and checks and balances, and really, if you like, a democratic culture, push the country to the brink. And of course, these leaders, these war fighters, as we sing time and time again in different countries, don't have the experience to govern for the people once you have a newly independent state.
I know that South Sudan is in the grip of a famine and a drought, but generally, is it a fertile country? Is it something of a breadbasket for the area? So were they fighting over resources like food and water?
Certainly the land, if you fly over the country, is extremely fertile. There's a lot of local producers. Right now, with the famine and with the conflict situation, most of the food from South Sudan is really imported from Kenya or Uganda. So the conflict has also created a situation where local economy has completely collapsed.
You were there and on the ground working as a political advisor, a key role. How did you see firsthand the effects of this war between the government and opposition forces in South Sudan?
Yeah, so my role was as a senior political advisor working for the political affairs unit of the UN Peacekeeping Mission in South Sudan, which is UNMISS in acronym. And really, our role was really sort of fourfold. Our primary responsibility is to protect the civilians of South Sudan using a combination of our political engagement, which is where I'm involved in, and also our military presence and also police presence. The other sort of main roles of the Peacekeeping Mission was really to monitor and investigate human rights, to create conditions that facilitate humanitarian assistance, but also to to help, if we can, support the implementation of the peace agreement and negotiate a settlement. Just in terms of that last part, in terms of sort of my role in the political affairs unit, it's been extremely difficult for the UN to have a good relationship with the government, because there's no sort of newly acquired independent state. Doesn't matter how bad the situation is. Nobody wants sort of 17,000 troops authorized by foreign countries to be on your soil monitoring what you're doing. So there's been always a very poor relationship between the UN and the government, and that also creates difficulties for the UN to deliver humanitarian assistance.
Yeah, I'm just thinking though, Kevin, about what you actually saw on the ground, the manifestation of this conflict.
You know, actually, one of my regrets, if you like, is actually not being able to see as much as I could because of really the way we work, because of the curfews, because of the requirement that you drive in convoys, and because you basically cannot be out during the nighttime. But in the interaction we have in Juba, of course, even though there's been fighting since December 2013, the government has been gradually gaining more territory, and most of the opposition leaders are now in exile in different states around Africa. So really, there's a situation where the government really has the upper hand. And this, in some ways, perhaps also presents an opportunity for the government to really address some of the issues that it couldn't address before, because it was focused on the fighting.
Tell me, though, about this huge compound that you were forced to live in, because, I mean, it's a vast city within a city, in a sense, and there's a lot of refugees actually in the UN compound, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is where it's very, very unique. So for most peacekeeping missions, you know, you have the UN staff, offices, and also sometimes their residence in a compound. But when it comes to South Sudan, it's very unique. Our compound in Juba is probably, if you like, 25 square kilometers, so 5x5, if you like, when it comes to a square. And the uniqueness in the mandate of the UN peacekeeping mission there is that, as we know, civilians have increasingly become a victim of conflict. Often they are specifically targeted by groups, and that's certainly the situation in South Sudan. So the UN's role has evolved in that where there's a need, as a matter of last resort, the UN peacekeeping mission must be prepared to open its compound to allow civilians to seek shelter. And this was the case in December 2013, when thousands and thousands of civilians basically were just en masse fleeing the conflict, and they sought refuge inside the UN compound.
Well, yeah, you certainly opened the doors of the compound. 200,000 refugees living in the UN compound, is that right?
Yes, they're not actually, of course, living right where we are working. There's a thin fence that separates the UN staff from the civilians seeking shelter. And they're on UN land, which is very unique, because that brings about certain sort of legal obligations that the UN may have, because these people are on UN land, even though they are within South Sudan, they're on UN land under UN sort of military protection. And this is meant to be really a last resort in very extreme situations and on a temporary basis. But as you have noted, they've been there for 3.5 years now, and it has become a very protracted issue that the mission is very concerned about.
Kevin, how is it possible, when you've got 200,000 refugees living inside the actual UN compound, to mediate and to do your job? Because would the UN be seen by the government of South Sudan as some sort of collaborator or participant in the conflict, if it's because it's targeting a lot of these people? Does it make the UN's mission very difficult?
Well, indeed. I mean, you have really hit on the head of one of the biggest issues. So for all peacekeeping missions, you know, one of the principles of peacekeeping is the impartiality of the UN, which means, you know, you're not biased towards any side. And certainly with the vast, vast majority of people seeking shelter within UN compounds belonging to the opposition, sort of political opposition, and of course, some of them actually do come from military background, and, you know, weapons have been found in UN compounds. That makes it very, very difficult for the UN in sort of two ways. As you've identified, it's the impartiality issue, that the UN may be seen to be on the side of the opposition forces, but also that creates a significant security concern for the UN, because simply you have a huge number of people that you got to take care of right next to you, but also that they may be, and they have been targets. For example, in July 2016, the protection civilian sites in Juba were targeted by various forces, including South Sudanese government forces.
I haven't touched yet on the famine that's been caused by this power struggle, because in many ways it is a politically induced famine. How bad is it becoming?
The famine is extremely bad situation. I mean, it's been declared in several parts of the country. And as you've correctly said, I mean, this is a man-made humanitarian disaster. And we have seen the entire collapse of sort of markets and market economy and also labor because of the sort of ongoing conflict, because of the insecurity and the displacement. I think the current displacement figure is about 4 million within South Sudan, and with about 2 million, as you said early on, going across borders.
I mean, that rivals anything we're seeing in Syria with the internal displacement. Are there any local voices at all, either in South Sudan or in any of the East African countries, that can play a particularly effective role in trying to get a ceasefire or revive the peace agreements there?
The main political actors really have been the regional actors. For example, IGAD, the Intergovernmental Agency for Development, which is the an Eastern African bloc of countries. They are the custodians of not only the 2015 peace agreement, which has collapsed, but also they are the key actors. For example, countries like Kenya, Uganda, Sudan, Ethiopia. These are the key countries that really have leverage on the different political leaders of South Sudan, because in reality, a lot of these current leaders of South Sudan have, you know, property, have family in these countries, and they used to seek shelter in these countries when they were fighting the North. So I think any kind of the more robust coercive measure the international community can take. For example, the United States in December last year did propose arms embargo and asset freezing. So the U.S. proposed that in the Security Council, which was voted down. Now, even if countries unilaterally impose these sanctions, we really rely on the regional bloc to be able to sort of enforce that for there to be any kind of real influence on the leaders of South Sudan.
Look, good luck, Kevin. I hope the situation in South Sudan improves. Kevin Chang is a specialist in international law and human rights and conflict prevention. He's worked in this area for over 15 years. Most recently, he's senior political affairs officer at the United Nations Mission in South Sudan. Thanks for being with us on Saturday Extra, Kevin.
Pleasure.